Whether you're looking for answers to specific life questions or seeking to become the best version of you possible, welcome to the Mental Breakdown and Psych Reg podcast, where we offer insight, information, and strategies based upon research and years of practice as clinical psychologists. So sit back, have a listen, and get connected with our hosts, Dr. Bernie Wilkinson and Dr. Richard Marshall. Welcome back. Good morning, Richard. We're recording this podcast very early in the morning. It is like 5:20 in the morning, and that's because we have a awesome guest with us today. We did a podcast a couple of weeks ago where I made the comment that the Ryan Anderson, who we interviewed from Australia, was the farthest phone conversation or conversation I've had in my life. Today, I think Trump's today beats that because we are talking with Dr. Bruce Cohen from New Zealand. That's even further.
It's on the last stop before Neptune or something.
That's right. Yeah. That's right. It blows my mind how, you know, we're 5 o'clock in the morning here and it's 11 o'clock at night where he is. So, amazing stuff. Yes. So, as we're getting started, Richard, tell us a little bit about Dr. Cohen as we get started with and talk about his book.
Well, we are excited about this this interview. But Dr. Cohen is currently a senior lecturer in sociology at the University of Auckland in New Zealand. He's originally from Essex, a little town in England, better known for, David Beckham always says that he's from the same town that Bruce Cohen is from. But no, David Beckham also hails from Essex. Dr. Cohen earned his doctorate from the University of Bradford in 2000 for his research on user understandings and meanings of mental illness. He subsequently did postdoctoral scholarship both in Germany at Humboldt University in Berlin and also in Australia at the University of South Australia in Adelaide. He has studied and written on mental health issues for over 20 years now, previously publishing in journals like Disability in the Global South, The Psychiatrist, and Science, Discourse, and Mind. His books, it's an impressive list. It includes Mental Health User Narratives, New Perspectives on Illness and Recovery, Being Cultural, and Psychiatric Hegemony, a Marxist Theory of Mental Illness, a fascinating look that we often don't take. He's currently finishing editorial work on the Routledge Handbook of Critical Mental Health, a 30-chapter volume, which is due out later this year. It's an impressive body of work, Dr. Cohen, and we appreciate you being here.
Thank you, guys. It's lovely to be with you as well. I'm speaking here from the future, obviously, being 18 hours ahead.
Yeah, Einstein talked about that, and I never understood his take on it either. But we'll soldier through.
I do hope that I will have a good day. But don't tell me what happens because I want to be surprised. But today we're going to talk about your book. One of the books that Richard just mentioned is right. And that's The Psychiatric Hegemony, A Marxist Theory of Mental Illness. And that was just published last year, right?
That's
right. So we're really excited to talk about this because there's a lot of important points and perspectives and ideas to be thinking about. And one of the things that you talk about in the book, especially through the first major portion of the book, is just the significant increase in mental illness over the past half century or so. I mean, you cite some pretty impressive statistics with, you know, the World Health Organization estimating over 450 million of the 7 billion people on Earth have a mental or behavioral disorder, and the rates just keep increasing. So tell us a little bit about your thoughts and theories about this significant increase.
Yeah, well, okay. Here's my central idea. So strap yourself in, guys. Okay, so I think the most significant thing, what I argue in the book, is the most significant thing that has happened over the last 40, 50 years is actually in the 1970s. We started to see a change from welfarism, that is kind of like welfare state economies, and this is across Western societies, not just the UK or the US. And we saw this move from welfarism to the period we are now in, which is neoliberalism. We saw a falling back of the state, and we saw the enforcement over time, slowly but surely, of neoliberal ideology. So, you know, what we see within some of these values is the reason why we see an expansion fundamentally in mental illnesses across the world. So it's quite a big structural argument to make, and obviously it's kind of like it's got a serious kind of Marxist structural analysis to it. But basically, what we see to begin with is the requirement on ourselves to actually fundamentally we move from this collective mentality to actually the idea of the individual as the site of responsibility. Rather than looking to the collective, the community, to the government to help us, and this is whether it refers to, you know, kind of things we take for granted, social welfare payments, or whatever, or retraining, we're actually neoliberalism is saying it's your responsibility now. You're responsible for yours. So it's basically the ideas of neoliberal ideology to make yourself fundamentally more marketable. So we see these ideas of actually people having to work on themselves over time to be more productive, to sell themselves more in the labour market, to be more positive, vibrant, for these. And of course, what we see during this period as well is the kind of deindustrialization and the coming of the information and service economies. So all of this builds up, I argue, in the book over a number of chapters, not just like I am now, to actually what we see in these new emerging diagnoses that come out from the 1980s onwards. I'm starting with the third edition of the DSM. Maybe we'll come back. Or maybe your listeners actually know what the DSM is already, I'm wondering.
We've mentioned it, a number of times. So yeah, hopefully, but we can talk about it again too. So no problem.
Okay, that's all cool. Yeah. Okay. So what we see there within these diagnoses that occur, like ADHD, like OCD, like PMDD, more and more we see actually the symptoms speaking to us, speaking to our fears, to our anxieties within this new marketplace. So basically, more effectively, what we see with these psychiatric symptoms of disorders, and I can give you some examples now. For instance, if we look at ADHD, of course, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, what we see is they denote the requirements for more productive and efficient students and workers. So for instance, symptoms include things like forgetting or losing homework, classic one. We also see failing to complete assignments for school or for the workplace, poor time management skills. People maybe won't believe this if they haven't seen ADHD symptoms in the DSM-5, but this is really kind of, these are real symptoms. So what we see is the DSM, which is the old, I would say, most important global document that speaks to what mental illness is and what it's not, and which mental illnesses exist in the world according to the state-of-the-art research. What we see here is basically it reflects very well the requirements of neoliberal society, and I argue neoliberal capitalism within this framework. So I appreciate within that, just to postscript that, that we can also, and scholars have, implicated other factors which seem more obvious than the ones I'm giving here, such as the involvement of drug companies in basically the promotion of the biomedical realities of new forms of mental illness and so forth. We see the ideas of professional expansion, you know, basically psychiatrists moving out of the asylum. They have to basically offer new services, fine cases, etc. We see that happening over the same period of time, 1970s till now. Globalization, of course, the growth in these mental illness figures can be explained by, you know, we're finding more cases, science is progressing and so forth. I think there's some real problems with those arguments, but I think some of the ones that scholars have mentioned, drug companies, etc., they're actually correct in their premises, but they're subservient to this structural modeling that I actually do within the book. Hope that was semi-clear.
Yeah, it was. It was, and I think it brings about some really interesting points because, you know, we've talked before about, you know, how you know, some of the things that we see, some of the challenging behaviors and that we see in schools that lead to diagnoses of ADHD, as you said, and some of these other things, that they do seem to be in response to the ever-increasing set of expectations and demands that we place on students. You know, I know here in the States, we've been talking a lot about, you know, the expectations that we have on students where, you know, we have fourth graders doing algebra and, you know, they're just pushing down the curriculum so that the more, you know, students are expected to do higher and higher level academics at younger and younger ages. And so, you know, we have kindergartners doing book reports and those kinds of things. So, you know, certainly it sounds like that what you're talking about kind of captures some of those kinds of issues.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I mean, on we've seen one of the biggest increases, and I think that's the kind of like where we're going at the moment. I mean, some incredible, particularly of course in your country, seeing an incredible kind of 35-fold increase in the numbers of young people diagnosed with mental illness over that time. So kind of like really incredibly large figures within right. That.
I think in our country, one of the diagnoses that Bernie and I both struggle with is oppositional defiant disorder. And I think that falls neatly into this category of maybe nothing more than social deviance and not really mental illness. You know, it's just kids saying no.
Yeah, absolutely. I had, I have a student who's just finished a master's on that very topic and came to similar conclusions as yourself, Richard.
Right. Yeah. So now when we think about this, and we kind of talked a little bit about this before we really started recording and everything, but I think it's interesting, and one of the things that we do talk about it here on the podcast is that There is this difference between perhaps those socially created conditions, like, you know, sometimes the socially created ADHD symptoms, because, you know, when we do workshops and stuff, Richard has this great slide of a hunter gatherer group, you know, and they're going out hunting and you know. He talks about how biologically we're still at that level. You know, that's we're still the same biologically as that. But yet, you know, we expect kids to sit in classrooms for, you know, 7.5 hours a day and sit still and quiet, and they're not allowed to talk at lunch and some of those kinds of things. But it does seem that some of the research now is coming out to talk about, you know, brain differences in kids, and perhaps, you know, we have two sets of these perspectives, or two sets of these kinds of problems, where we have some that, you know, have some identifiable root, whereas others are more of these socially based
social constructs,
yeah. that your book is highlighting very well. Does any of the researcher that you've been doing or reading or writing about talk about any of those kinds of things?
So are basically saying some forms of mental illness as biological reality, or at least studies beginning to suggest that there's an underlying brain disease biological cause.
Right.
Yeah. In fact, I challenge this idea in the book. I draw on years of scholarship, but also some very recent good scholarship. I don't want to break it all down here, but maybe we can kind of like just cover some of the main points. Could be here all day otherwise. There's a fundamental elephant in the room often. I'm glad we're actually speaking about it, about actually the validity to mental illness, to any diagnosis. I think that's important and seldom actually kind of like raised, even in sociology of mental health. I think there's a problem. I find this at conferences, by the way. I kind of will go along and I will kind of like say certain things. And basically, it's like other conferences now. It feels like you're speaking a different language, strangely enough. And what I do in the book is basically draw together a lot of evidence from other people's work. I have to say, there's a little bit of my original work in there, but mainly it comes from other scholarship that's been done already. One of the recent books that I draw on, and I'd also kind of like recommend to your listeners, is by Robert Whittaker and Lisa Cosgrove. It's on institutional corruption, and sorry, I've lost the title of it again. Psychiatry Under the Influence is the title. And what they do in the book is slightly different from my work, obviously. They're not Marxists. They're just, Robert's a journalist, investigative journalist by trade. He's a Cosgrove critical psychologist. What they set out is to explain what has happened over the same period of time that I'm really looking at with neoliberalism. They're saying, how has the biomedical model become accepted as a fundamental truth and reality? And they take you through the phases of how there was a partnership between pharmaceutical companies, and it was seen as like be positive and it produced more research and we get to know more. It would be typical progression in science. What it actually has ended up with, they argue, and they've got very kind of like, I think, substantial work to support that, is basically the science, the knowledge we have on what this thing called mental illness is, and if it exists, how it works, has actually been corrupted, and we've actually gone in a completely different direction. And so they kind of like have many sources cited about, obviously, the studies that the hidden studies, as well as the ones that we actually know about, that the DEA sees on, the classic drugs, Xanax, Prozac, and so on. So it actually shows that placebo, the experimental drug is no more effective than placebo, sometimes less effective. This is a real problem with the whole kind of that mental illness is caused by brain, etc., etc. And we have many kind of senior psychiatrists are reported in this book as well that state clearly that this is a myth, this idea of kind of chemical imbalances in the brain, and like a serious academic psychiatrist who actually studies the data do not actually kind of like give this any credence. For instance, people like Pease, who was the, I think he's still the or he was the editor of one of the APA's official psychiatric journals, and basically came out a number of times on the blog and in the editorials and basically said, look, I don't know what's going on here. We just don't have any evidence for this, but it continues. Now, that is obviously very, very concerning. And so this is kind of like when I put the evidence together, and I have to say, you guys hopefully know a lot more about the studies and the tests and the brain scans and the rest than I do. But when I actually bring together like the evidence does not suggest psychiatrists actually agree on what a particular mental illness is, or who's got mental illness and who hasn't, which has been old, you know, I mean, we're going back to the 70s and Rosenhan studies of being sane in the same places and so forth. So, you know, when we start to look at the evidence, it doesn't look like any progress has been made. So, you know, as a sociologist, I have to say, well, if there's real problems here, then what is really going on? When we look at the history of psychiatry as well, and of course, I spent some time in my book doing this, we start to build up some other arguments about, you know, psychiatry and associated professionals as institutions of social control. It's funny, actually, it's something like, I think everybody within the mental health field in the 60s and 70s had an idea that these critiques were there and these arguments were, you know, had validity. And it's interesting, and we might say that's the product of neoliberalism as well, but basically over the last 30, 40 years, these are lost. And when you kind of present this stuff now, like I say, even at sociology conference, you are kind of treated like, that guy's a bit weird. We're always kind of, where he gets his kind of like findings from. This is mainly, it's kind of actually you guys, you know, critical psychologists, critical psychiatrists, they actually write these books. And it's so, you know, it's you guys, not actually sociologists doing this. I'm one of the few. I think, you know, there's Phil Brown, if you've come across the name, an American guy, and he wrote a book in the 1970s, Marxist direction in, or towards a Marxist perspective of psychology or something. It's like the last sociologist to actually write a Marxist book in this area. Really.
Bruce, while we're on this, you remember the old Soviet Union, where if you were...
I remember it. I'm 48.
48. You don't remember it.
I do.
No. It's like talking to Bernie. So in the old Soviet Union...
He teases me about that all the time, Bruce, because he talks about things from, you know, long time ago.
The 70s. Long time ago.
The 70s.
Long time ago, Bruce. Yeah. Bernie and I have discussions of my experiences and his reading of history in high school. But the old Soviet Union would put you in a mental hospital. If you were a political dissident, you were put in a mental hospital. Yeah. Would you see that as just the most extreme expression of this idea of social deviance, that they actually implemented the policy, whereas in our country it's couched in sort of medical jargon rather than political?
I'm going to answer your question sideways on. There's an interesting example that I give in the book that I like very much to as an example, that the overall argument for me is that within any society, the psychiatric profession, the mental health system, the business of mental health, is very conservative. It will basically follow the dominant norms and values of that society. And what you will see in the manual, in the local manual, whether it's the Russian one or the American one or the Third Reich one, it will actually reflect the dominant ideology discourse of that time. So interesting example was psychiatry in the Soviet Union. You seem to know stuff about Russia, had this diagnosis of sluggish schizophrenia. Mm-hmm. And of course, Mikhail Gorbachev, you know, some of the symptoms of sluggish schizophrenia is things like delusions of reform. This is actually a symptom of sluggish schizophrenia in Soviet Union. Along comes Mikhail Gorbachev, and of course, with kind of suggesting, hey, you know what, perestroika, this will be groovy, you know, freedom of the press, etc. Mm-hmm. We should think about this one in the late 80s. And in, you know, there's this lovely story about actually senior psychiatrists got really worried that the new head of the Politburo was basically mad. Mm-hmm. You know, basically he had sluggish schizophrenia, right? Because he had one of the symptoms was delusions of reform. What do you know? Kind of basically Gorbachev seems to have delusions of reform. You know, but that's just one of, you know, many examples that I give in the book. I wouldn't say it's particularly, you know, what is the beautiful ugly thing, I guess, about scientific institutions, about medicine, is that's a more effective way of silencing resistance, you know, to silence political ideas. You know, the suffragettes in the 19th century, you know, were a typical victims of the hysteria diagnosis and so forth, you know. So basically people getting uppity, you know, similar kind of issues elsewhere. So my you know, when I talk about, for instance, psychiatry in the Third Reich, which is, I think, for me, the most scary chapter of psychiatry's history, and it's amazing psychiatry, Western psychiatry, actually survived such an attempt. I draw on Peter Breggin's work here a lot. You know, we see this in every Western society, and in fact, we're kind of like, there's now debates going on about, of course, Korea, also China. It's an interesting one that's going on between Alan Kleinman and other people. Is this good psychiatry? Is this bad authoritarian psychiatry? Debates going back and forwards at the moment. Interesting. Fundamentally, you know, psychiatry is an institution of social control, product of this society of capitalism. That's my argument in the book.
Yeah, I think that's, I think it's fascinating. And one of the reasons, you know, why it seems to be, one of the reasons why it seems to be that way, you know, unlike other branches of medicine, you know, there's not, you know, clinical tests. There's not a blood test that you can give to identify, you know, this blows patients' minds, you know, when they come in and they think that they may have bipolar or something. They say, I think I have a chemical imbalance. You know, I need a test for a chemical imbalance. There is no such thing as a test for a chemical imbalance. And I think, unlike, you know, cardiology or some of the other branches of medicine, you know, we don't have those kinds of tests that you can give to, you know, absolutely identify, you know, that's where the problem is. You can see it right there, unless there's some kind of tumor or, you know, some other type of insult to the brain. You know, there is nothing like that we have in our field. And it leads to these kinds of, I guess we could call them misuses of, you know, your professional obligation and your professional position to affect patients and individuals in that way.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, there was some back to what happened with So there's a big discourse, Bernie, that around the misuse of psychiatry, it's interesting that I mentioned it in chapter 7 of my book. It's used, you know, Western psychiatry will talk about the misuse of psychiatry. We'll talk about the misuse of their profession, and they'll kind of give examples of Soviet Union, Cuba, North Korea, you know, used to say about China, and now that debate's kind of going back and forth now, and so on. So, but they don't look inwards. It's very, very seldom that actually the psychiatric profession looks inwards and actually says, you know, I mean, like Metzl actually did. He's a psychologist. You know, Metzl actually built this argument of, well, what's happened here is basically psychiatry have pathologized young males as basically being aggressive, as in schizophrenia, as in need of like having medication, etc., and were subsequently locked up in US institutions at a higher rate. So, you know, there's a debate. Hopefully I can help add to that, along with Peter Bragan and stuff, you know, following on from, you know, the Holocaust stuff we can discuss if you want, but I always think like that's going to make me sound a little bit conspiratorial more than I already do. But it's based a lot on Peter's research and also kind of like people at Nuremberg and so forth. But, you know, the kind of, is it a misuse of psychiatry? Or is it just actually the use of psychiatry? That is a scary thing, I know, to contemplate as people within the mental health profession. You know, is that
Yeah, when I listen to you, it suddenly occurs to me that there is no good psychiatry or bad psychiatry, regardless of what country you're talking about. Psychiatry is psychiatry. That's your basic it's your premise. There's no good Chinese psychiatry is no worse than U.S. psychiatry.
Well, it's just perpetuating the social norms of that culture.
Right. And that's absolutely true. I taught a course in the sociology of education, and the recurring theme in the course was schools are places not where we educate children, it's where we socialize children. And if you can't be socialized, then you're deviant. But that's the primary purpose of schools. And what you're saying is that's also the primary purpose of psychiatry.
Absolutely. I mean, as you know, public institutions, which as opposed to private institutions, are meant to have a particular function other than serve the public good, much more effective as kind of institutions of social control. Even if you want to argue that's a good thing, you know, to actually socialize, you know, our kids into certain kind of values. But nevertheless, I mean, I think there's, you know, there has to be a recognition, and that's, of course, like I'm suggesting, has dropped off a lot of work in this area. I've actually, actually having understanding that this is about social deviance, it's about institutions of social control, you know, whether we want to say that's a fantastic thing or not.
Absolutely. And you know, kind of taking this, you alluded to it a few minutes ago, and so it would be an easy transition now to kind of talk a little bit about big pharma and the influence that pharmaceutical companies have had on the development of psychiatry in the mental health field in general. You mentioned some diagnoses a few moments ago that, you know, that weren't even didn't even exist, right, you know, 10 years ago, but are now very commonly identified and very commonly treated through medications. And so we have sort of this dual effect and dual impact that the pharmaceutical companies have had in promoting the identification of disorders that may not have existed before, but also, of course, the production of medications to presumably treat those illnesses. That makes them, you know, of course, there's been lots of reports about how that is done here in the United States, where, you know, the markup on medications are tremendous. And, you know, so you have people who have to pay hundreds of dollars a month for medication that they say is the only medication to treat this particular condition that, again, may not have existed just 10 years ago, but here you are with it. So I like a lot of your perspectives about the influence of big pharma and all of this, all of these issues.
Yeah. Well, thanks. Yeah, you guys don't seem to like big pharma very much, do you?
We struggle. You know, we have certainly seen patients, because we were talking about this before we called you, because we have certainly seen patients who benefit from medication. You know, there are those who, you know, struggle with symptoms that really cause some dysfunction that disallow them from being able to do some of the things that they need to do and that they want to do, and they just can't access some facility that they need to do. And they get on medication and it helps them. But we have certainly also seen psychiatrists, and I'm going to be cautious how I say this because I know that Richard will kick me under the table. We have certainly seen psychiatrists who, you know, every time a patient goes to see them, they're placed on a new medication and then another medication to treat the side effects of the other medication. Mm-hmm. And we know that this is very problematic. You know, we also teach about the origin of a lot of our psychiatric medications that, you know, so many psychiatric medications came about in ways that would never happen in any other branch of medicine. You know, the antipsychotics being discovered because, you know, the original one was a antihistamine, you know, and the same thing with antidepressant medications. So that would never happen in any other branch of medicine, but, you know, it is commonplace here in psychiatry.
Yes, it's very interesting, isn't it? I have a kind of like a take that, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I feel like the marketplace, if we can call it that, for academic research publications in our area, it's kind of like, it's really kind of getting quite heavy with, how can I put it? You know, the kind of discussion we're having about medicalization, about the overuse of drugs. There's a lot of those books around. There's, you know, there's Cracked by Davies. Mm-hmm. There's one by Paris, Psychiatry on the Couch. So lots of these are kind of like around, basically, you know, psychiatrists complaining that basically, you know, biomedical model has, you know, big pharma has too much power. That, you know, we should be involved in real doctoring. That's what we used to do. Now we're just, you know, prescribing medication. Lots of these books, like, and you know, that's some of my evidence in the book, of course, is kind of like is paying attention to that. I'm not an anti-drugs person either, per se. I have to say, I do have my own drugs, not any antidepressants, I like to point out, but you know, alcohol, cigarettes, coffee, etc., various things, not that that should affect my objective academic assessment of drugs in this case. But you're right. You know, I've had like colleagues, as well as, of course, my work with users' experience of mental illness, many other occasions where people say, look, you know, this is good for me. It means I can get out of house. It means I can go to parties. I'm no longer kind of feeling socially excluded, or I kind of like leave the home, etc. You know, so... In a way, I kind of have like, why not use those? I don't know, you know, the problem is actually saying basically you have this mental illness, which is real, and it does these things to you, and this drug is actually correcting them. That's a different thing. All drugs have an effect on us, and it's fantastic when they, you know, when they have a positive effect, whether it's an illegal drug or it's kind of like taking Prozac or whatever. I have some, yeah, it's interesting about the, you were talking about Forazine there, weren't you, with the big one in the mid-50s.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's interesting how that was seen as a miracle drug. Yeah. But if we look at that one as an example, you know, this was basically seen as the first drug that was worked, as according to Lieberman, who used to be the head of the APA, you know, it had symptoms, so we could prove it was kind of biological, and it could assist in getting people out of the hospitals, and that's why deinstitutionalization happened, because we got better drugs. Now, you might be aware of kind of alternative history on this from people like Andrew Scull, which have actually examined the evidence and actually say, well, these doesn't tie up, actually, you know, either. We were already getting people out of the institutions before Forazine came along. Also, kind of like people who had Forazine, like in Europe, didn't actually, there wasn't a change in rates until much later on. What we do see in the US in the mid-50s, of course, is basically a change in fiscal policy. So basically, you know, we have public psychiatry, basically state-funded, maxing out, basically. The states can't pay for any more, etc. Something needs to be done. When the states are actually given the option by, and this is an interesting thing in some of the scholarship you look at, is actually pharmaceutical companies going beyond the psychiatrists, who are a bit skeptical about this Forazine business and its effectiveness, but actually going to the state authorities and actually saying, you know what, this is like a chemical lobotomy. This is actually really cheap, and less people will die than with lobotomies, and so forth. This is fantastic. And actually, state authorities take into it, and actually, it then becoming this kind of myth subsequently about, well, it's because the drugs worked. Which, when you think about it, there were kind of like the much of the 20th century, that first part, basically, there were some sort of drugs in hospitals as well as outpatients. And psychiatrists are really embarrassed about doing that, because kind of effectively as just sedating them, you know, people, yeah. Like, you know, like zombies and so forth. So you have those kind of issues, which I think is a great historical example, and I draw on a lot of these too, to say, well, you know, I think kind of there's the kind of like roots in a way of the problems we have today. Of course, 1980 and the reinforcement of the biomedical model in the DSM-3 is crucial as well within that. You know, this kind of crises at the point in the 1970s for psychiatry. So I kind of like, I don't want to say by a big pharma are cool by me and it's a kind of livestock problem. Of course it is. Of course it's like a serious, any Marxist is going to say this is kind of like, it's an obvious part of how the market profits, even in public services, not only private services, of course. You know, this kind of, we're topping $40 billion for all kind of like psychotropic drugs kind of like sold year on year. It's incredible. That gives, like, of course, Big Pharma an incredible amount of power and incredible kind of like reasons to want to keep the biomedical model as it is, to keep APA as they are in their pockets and so forth. Yeah, we know that the DSM-5 committee is basically, the majority of them, of course, had financial interests with pharmaceutical companies and so on. So we kind of know there's an awful lot of conflicts of interest and problems with that. However, here's my kind of chief point, just to end this diatribe of mine. In my book, I kind of like, I try to take through some of these issues and say, Big Pharma is not concerned to actually identify the original mental illness or mental construct or kind of like the label in this case. You know, all they're interested in is basically, you know, we've got a drug and we don't know what to do with it. Can we put it, you know, can we make it basically a drug for social anxiety disorder or whatever? So the significance of that is psychiatry, academic research within psychiatry still has responsibility, I argue, for actually producing the original kind of like, where are we going? What's the kind of the big issue? What do we want to be looking at? And that comes from, taking my argument to its logical conclusion, actually as an institution of social control and institution of holism, it follows the dominant norms and values. So for instance, the work on shyness, we can trace it back and find it comes from academic psychiatry, which is like basically people like Zimbardo start to talk about. I don't think it's a mental disorder, he says, but I think it's going to be problematic in the future for our sons and daughters to actually be shy, to actually not be able to talk in public, to not have these social skills as society changes. That's basically, you know, the origins of social anxiety disorder that we have in DSM-5.
Wow. Yeah, as you were talking, I wish I would have thought about this earlier so I can make sure that what I'm about to say is correct. But you know what? I'll say things. Richard will correct me because he will remember. But what you're saying fits very nicely with what happened with Prozac, because if I remember correctly, as Prozac was approaching the timeline to where it was going to lose its ability to, you know, sort of maintain its, it was going to become a generic, you know, that is right around the time that PMDD became a diagnosis. And then, of course, the same company that created Prozac created this new medication that was basically Prozac again, but they were able to market a brand new medication that was now protected. And now they had another medication that was specific to this PMDD that couldn't be used or couldn't be made as a generic, and so they were able to corner the market on that as well. And so that financial focus that Big Pharma has so often, you know, certainly has an influence again on the identification of these disorders and medications.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a drive. Obviously, it's a key driver, as Peter Conrad and many others have pointed out. Key driver of medicalization is Big Pharma. Yeah, they've got a key concern, of course, to do that. You know, the profit margins, shareholders. However, like actually, what we're also concerned here, if we want to uncover the kind of like how we get to this state of an expanded political economy of mental illness, of these labels, of the whole thing, we have to look beyond just Big Pharma, which I kind of think is a very simple point to make. The bigger one is, like, I think Whitaker and Cosgrove's point about, actually, it's not just Big Pharma, it's actually, there's a lot that psychiatry gains from this as well. So, and we have to consider, basically, you know, the institution as a whole, as a kind of corrupt body, because it has not followed, obviously, it hasn't put the needs of the public first. You know, and what we have with the drugs, of course, is, and what was fantastic in the 1950s at the time, was they look like proper doctors now, of course. Mm-hmm. They're kind of like, you know, the symbol, as Andrew Scull says, of being a proper doctor is being able to prescribe that drug. You know, that's a key consideration. You know, then you've got the money that the prestige that comes with academic research, with scholarships, with the funding of professional bodies. We know that Big Pharma, they have a department that writes these research articles and has people who are basically are on the kind of like the pay bill of Big Pharma, and basically will kind of like have the names put on the front, you know, for a fee, etc. This is all documented in many of these books.
It's so interesting, and you know, some of the and this is off script also, my bad. This upsets Richard when I do this, but it makes me think of some of the other things that we talk about on the podcast very often, and that is, you know, that the sort of newly emerging, relatively newly emerging field of functional medicine that looks at the influence of diet and exercise and sort of lifestyle things, and how the things that we do in our everyday life sometimes manifest as anxiety and depressive symptoms. So again, kind of going with the notion that some of the much of this may not be a actual disorder as much as it is a response to things that you're doing in your lifestyle, things that you're consuming. You know, the you know, not that we're going to get really we're going conspiratorial enough, we don't have to go any farther to go into, you know, how the food industry, you know, with all the processed foods and things like that are kind of getting into our systems, and how that is affecting our overall behaviors and mental health and emotions and things like that. So I think it's all fascinating.
Yes, indeed. It is.
Well, it's what, you know, Thomas Sats calls the problems in living. You know, we have these problems in living, and we all do as a species. We have them. And I think we've medicalized, you know, if I couldn't attend the public schools that my children attended, the demands, I don't think I could have met the expectations that my children were expected to meet. I needed recess, I needed breaks, I needed to be able to move around and talk. And my children were not allowed to do that. And I think that's why we have to resort to medication, to, you know, chemical straitjackets, as we say. Mm. Yeah. So.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, you have a lot of scholars basically saying, well, you look at the ADHD symptoms, basically, you're really looking at the requirements of modern schooling.
That's right. No, that's what we believe. Yeah. Is it?
Yeah, more C work, less kind of like shouting out the answers, etc. Like we were doing in our day.
Yeah, we were allowed to go outside and play when we needed to.
Well, and what's fascinating is the educational model that everybody is coveting right now, that the Finland model that seems to be so effective, is the one that says, you know, 5 and 6 year olds need to be outside playing for, you know, 5 hours a day instead of sitting in a classroom at a desk for, you know, 7.5 hours. So, you know, I think that we had a local school from our area here, went to Finland and spent a couple months there learning about their system. And, you know, it is prohibited to do some academic work with kindergartners there. You know, it is just focusing on, you know, socialization and interactions and relationships and those kinds of things. Those things that are really important for developing the emotional and behavioral foundation from which the kids are going to develop those future behaviors.
Mm. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
So, kind of shifting slightly again, you know, we talk about, you know, and again, this was something that you alluded to a little bit earlier, how in psychiatry, you know, psychiatry has evolved into this field that really tries to, you know, say that they're the science of looking at the brain and treating the brain for these mental health conditions. And as we've talked about, you know, there's no test to identify chemical imbalances, and there's no test to really say that, you know, you can't do a neuroimaging test and say, okay, this person has ADHD, this person doesn't. There's some research coming out that suggests there may be some confirmatory types of things, but you can't make a diagnosis solely based upon that. And it seems as though that perspective of saying that, okay, this condition is based upon, you know, something going wrong in your brain, really does take out and remove the possibility of other etiologies. It removes the possibility of other factors that could be influencing, you know, these behaviors or symptoms or whatever we want to call them. And it sounds like that kind of goes in line with a lot of your perspectives.
Are we, sorry, I'm going to summarize your question and tell me.
I don't even know what the question was, to be honest.
I'm not the only one.
I was thinking maybe that there's obviously this dominant idea of within psychiatry at the moment of biomedicine, of brain disease, of we're going to find the genetic cause of every single mental illness, and that maybe that excludes a lot of other ideas that have previously being broached, and that there may be more evidence for actually out there already.
The thing that we were just talking about with education, you know, I can't tell you how many times a school has recommended a parent to send their child to us for testing for ADHD, you know, to look at, you know, to see if they meet the diagnostic criteria for ADHD. And or for a learning disability or something like that, because they're not doing well in school. And we do the evaluation, and in fact, the child is perfectly fine. There's absolutely nothing wrong with the child. And, you know, that's when I give the diagnosis of it's a curriculum disorder. The curriculum is inappropriate for the child's developmental, you know, level, and the child is developmentally appropriate. And it's just a disorder of the curriculum. And but the way that our field tends to focus on things, it doesn't really take into account some of those types of possibilities.
Yeah, I mean, that must be very hard as well. I mean, I imagine like having that conversation with the parent is sometimes problematic as well, when the parent is maybe coming back and saying, but I've had a look online and I think this absolutely is, you know, he's got all the symptoms. He forgets his homework. He's not kind of paying attention in class as much as he should.
And then I say, but he's five, he's supposed to of course he forgets things, he's just a kid. But yeah, you know, that's it is very difficult to talk to those parents about that, because, you know, they I think that we have also sort of developed this need to identify. We have a need to label what we're seeing. And once we get that label, parents oftentimes seem to sort of be satisfied. You know, I did an evaluation one time, and I've talked about this before, where, you know, a family came in because their little one had been diagnosed with autism. And, you know, they come in and we're meeting and talking, and I'm talking with the little one, and we're interacting, and I mentioned to the parents, I said, you know, he's doing a lot of things that are not, you know, characteristic of someone with autism. I don't know that that's really what's going on. Let's have him see, you know, a speech language pathologist and see if we can develop his language a little bit and see if it's really just something like that. The parents never came back to see me again and because they were they wanted, even though a diagnosis of autism sort of has certain implications or suggests certain implications, that was more satisfying to them because it had a label, it was identified, and then there could be a very direct treatment path that they could follow. And it's very challenging.
Yeah, and I would say on that issue, following the argument of my book, and I didn't say too much about it in my book, to be honest, but about this issue of parents is also kind of like, it is a management tool. I mean, Nicholas Rose kind of says, actually, you know what? Basically, we agree, myself and Nicholas Rose, we agree on a central set of ideas that basically neoliberalism has meant that we now have so many more kind of counselors, experts, governing, as he put it, governors of the soul. You know, that basically governing our emotions, of kind of being able to, you know, give us help and advice of these emotions at every level, down to, like, I don't know, Oprah Winfrey and horoscope readers and blah, blah, that these are all actually useful in managing our multiple kind of tasks and functions in this society, you know, the complexities of neoliberalism. I argue something different. I argue that actually this is depoliticizing. What are fundamentally kind of problems of capitalism, the kind of like social economic conditions, and so on. So, for instance, when you see this happening with parents, where kind of like, as some people have called it, I know it happened in Australia, the rush for diagnosis, for autism diagnosis, recently, and actually saying, well, this is a way of actually, you know, of managing the kind of the concern about the kind of kids and kids getting on in the classroom and stuff, you know, of actually think about the surveillance of parents now compared to our parents.
Yeah.
You know, and I'm not kind of like saying, oh, the good old days or something, but just saying, like, actually that kind of feeling of, you know, your kid, the anxieties of your kid could fail, and it seems your kid can fail at, I don't know, 3, 4, 5, 6 years old, and already it's kind of basically, oh, he's not going to make it. He's a failure. I don't know about you guys. I was like at this crappy, you know, I got a few kind of qualifications and just struggled out into a college. You know, I didn't know what the hell I wanted to be. I thought I'd go into a factory and that'll be it or something, you know. But, you know, I kind of like, so, yeah, the intensity of how we're living under these conditions. This is all kind of like part of, so I'm not kind of blaming the parent. I'm not blaming the kids. I'm not blaming for people for taking drugs or going for diagnosis. I'm trying to explain the world we live in terms of, like, why we have this expansion of diagnosis. You know, why we actually feel better when we have a label, perhaps, now, and so forth.
I completely agree, because, you know, you think about parents in the grocery store, you know, when their kid is misbehaving or not doing, if it was just the parent and the child in the store, it probably would be just fine. But as soon as the parent feels as though they're being judged or evaluated or, you know, seen in a negative light by other parents in the store, then all of a sudden, you know, then the behavior is really problematic, and they have to respond, and they have to act, and they have to do something. So yeah, I agree with that. Yeah. So, but we have kept you for a long time.
past your bedtime.
No problem. I have so much enjoyed this discussion. I was terrified for 2 weeks about this, but actually I've enjoyed myself.
Well, after reading your book, I was too.
Yeah. Well, you know, and when we first were getting connected with you, and we were thinking about what we would be talking about and kind of the book in general and everything, it was a little bit, we were trying to figure out what to do, because it is, as you said, you know, it's somewhat controversial. It's not the mainstream line of thought as it relates to this, but I think that there's a lot of aspects that you mentioned in the book that are really important that warrant more research and more investigation and more discovery, because, you know, we are talking about, you know, ourselves, our health, and the health of our children, and the health of our society in general.
Yeah, absolutely. And of course, it's, you know, it's challenging to do this work. And God knows, like, you know, I get challenged a lot. Although I have to say, like, after writing this book, I've had a lot of lovely feedback from psychiatrists, from you guys, obviously, from users, survivors, consumers of services. And I find that overall that I get good reception, although it's kind of challenging. And actually, you know, sometimes the ironic thing about this whole thing is, like, I get challenged maybe the most, or I have the most problems from my colleagues, from actually fellow sociologists, who actually, I don't know, this is kind of the way it seems to have gone now, that kind of like, why are you still writing about this? I thought we'd settled it, you know, actually mental illness is definitely there, you know, and we should just get on and see and find the, you know, the cases, and we should help these communities, and you're just setting us back, etc. Whereas, like, I hope I'm actually doing a public service by raising issues that maybe, you know, not enough people I think, are.
Well, you sort of anticipated my next comment, which was going to be when I first heard about your work. I said, oh, he's a Marxist. I haven't talked to a Marxist since the 60s. But yeah. I said, oh, he's a Marxist. And I just assumed that your book would be this conspiratorial class warfare. And it's much deeper and much better than that. And I think much more useful. So I appreciated reading it, getting your perspective. I have to confess, as I was reading it, I was thinking, how am I ever going to explain this to my doctoral students? But this helped. Your work, I think, is making a wonderful, very thoughtful contribution that needs to continue to be discussed. And so I really appreciate it. And I'm sure our audience will too.
Yeah.
Yep. So thank you.
Thank you, Richard. That's just a lovely thing to say, and it kind of makes, you know what it is with writing these kind of tomes and then kind of wondering if anybody's going to read it or if you did the right thing.
Yeah, and stuff. I hope they do. So, I hope they do. It's a perspective that we all need to pause and think about and consider very carefully.
Yeah, we'll definitely include a link to, I didn't look it up, and I should have, as I'm sitting here thinking about it. I should have looked it up to make sure that everybody can get it on Amazon. And so I'll include a link to Amazon, but I'll also, you know, I'll ask you, of course, how people can follow you and read more of your work and all of that. And I'll include all of those links in the show notes as well, so people can read more.
Thank you. I would, yes, on the, I'd like to apologize to everybody. It's not my decision. It's the publisher's decision. Palgrave, they've been very good, very brave to actually go with this book. But as with the last one, it's only available in hardback at the moment, and it costs an absolute fortune. So I'm trying to find ways around it that's nothing illegal, obviously. So I would I'd encourage, obviously, people to get it into their local libraries, academic libraries. People who have connections to some libraries have Palgrave Connect and can actually, and if they do in their library for an institution, they can get a full download of the PDF, which is something in 2 years' time, there'll be a paperback.
Okay. Okay. Well, that's certainly good to know.
Yeah. So my apologies about that. I always feel kind of bad at this point that, you know, obviously I'd love if it was just available for $10 to everybody or less, or free. So, yeah.
Well, we wrote in 2012, we wrote our parent ebook. So this is just a very short story to tell you how much we can appreciate what you're saying. We wrote a parenting book for just, you know, popular press. It's about 200 pages or so. Mm-hmm. And we were working with this publishing company, and they were very eager, very excited to publish it for us and everything. And they sent us some of the proofs and everything and had us sign a contract, and we did everything. And then they sent us the thing, and they were going to charge $150 for it. And we said, whoa, wait a minute, this is not a textbook. This is just like, we want just parents to buy it. We want it in, yeah. You know.
Yeah, the only parents who would have purchased it at that price were ours.
were us, yeah. And so we ended up having to back out of the contract and had to go through all that. And we ended up self-publishing because that's when we started our self-publishing business because that was such an awkward, unusual, bizarre situation. Because they weren't going to back down. They weren't going to back out. It was $150. It's like, well, you know, that's how much we have to charge for it. And say, okay, well.
Ah, good grief.
Good luck.
So, we're good, but we're not $150.
That's right. Yeah, I know. We're kind of, you know what it's like, guys. You're, when you're in academia, I mean, somebody else kind of said, why don't you self-publish? And I said, well, we're stuck in this chain of peer review and stuff, you know, where it's like they basically, they nail you in a way. It's basically, is this kind of closed market where you published, and you know, the academic worth has, in this terrible environment, is not kind of respected.
Right.
I just wanted to say other places where people can actually get hold of me. Obviously, I am a public intellectual. I am paid by the taxpayers, obviously New Zealand taxpayers, but let's just kind of call it the global community. We work for you, for the people. So happy that you get in touch with me. My email, we have my email up, so I don't have to mention it here.
Yeah, I'll put it up on the show notes.
Okay, lovely. And obviously, I've got a Twitter account. My university homepage, you can find out more about my research, and my academia.edu page, if you search for me, people can download most of my writings from there. Unfortunately, not the book.
But okay.
It's a start.
Well, fantastic. Yeah, I'll definitely include links to all of that in the show notes so people can follow you. And Bruce, it has been fantastic talking with you early in the morning here, late at night there. And, you know, but I do want to, you know, mention that when your next book comes out, The Handbook of Critical Mental Health, we would love to have you back and we can talk about that and you know, kind of go through some of the new stuff that you're writing.
You from the future once again.
Yes. Yes, absolutely. So, but we so appreciate your time and whether it's for the next book or for anything else, or anytime you ever want to come back on the show, just reach out to me and let me know. And we'd love to have you.
You're too kind, guys. Yeah, it's been a blast. It's been a pleasure.
Yep.
Fantastic.
For us too.
Fantastic.
Thank you.
So, all right. Well, so with that, we're going to call it a day. Well, we're going to call it
a
morning.
Begin a day.
Bruce will call it a day. So until next time, stay happy, stay healthy, and forget to be afraid.